Hello, and thank you for joining this Quantum to Cosmos Festival program. My name is Michele Mosca, and I'm an associate member at Perimeter Institute and deputy director of the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo. Welcome to those of you at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and to those of you joining us online from all around the world. This event is the first lecture in the Q2C lecture series presented by KPMG. These lectures wouldn't have been possible without their interest in science communication and generous support of the festival. So a warm thank you to KPMG. Before we begin the lecture, I will ask that for those of you in the theater, please turn off your BlackBerries and phones. And for those of you at home, please share news of this presentation by emailing the q2cfestival.com link to a friend or a colleague. You can also follow us on Twitter at q2cfestival. Our speaker today, David Corey, works on building quantum processors based on nuclear spins, electron spins, neutrons, superconducting devices, optics, combinations of these things, and more. He does experiments and also does theoretical work. In addition to being a brilliant researcher, he's an outstanding mentor and teacher. He was a pioneer of nuclear magnetic resonance, also known as NMR, quantum computing. And he comes today to tell us about the fascinating uses this exotic technology has for the challenges of everyday life. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Corey.
Thank you, Mike, and I would like to thank the organizers and the audience for coming and joining with us here. And what I would like to tell you about today is a little bit different than what you might hear in the rest of the festival. I want to talk to you about using ideas of quantum information processing, quantum theory, new quantum devices, and to show you how they touch our lives directly. And so I'm going to talk about some very simple everyday items that require quantum mechanics and whose use today is actually improved by the recent advances in quantum information theory. So what I'm going to do is to have a short story describing quantum coherence and quantum superposition. And I'm going to use a device called a microwave interferometer to describe that for you. And we'll do that in a few minutes. And then I'm going to show you that the ideas of superposition and coherence that were essential for that microwave interferometer can translate into control with nuclear spins. And the fun thing about nuclear spins is that though for a microwave interferometer, I have to do that in my lab with lots of equipment around it, spins, we all have them in our body. They're in everything we look at. And so we can imagine that we have quantum computers interspersed everywhere in the environment around us, and we can interact with them quantum mechanically, something that we don't normally see in our everyday life. But first, let me try to convince you that quantum mechanics changes the rules. Okay, so I want you to think back to when you were a kid and you were playing a game and your older sibling at some point changed the rules so that they won all the time. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to take the classical rules and we're going to change them to some quantum rules so that we can get an advantage which wasn't available in the classical world. And I could do this with equations, but I'm going to throw away equations in this talk, and we'll talk about experiments, really. So we have a game, and the game involves Alice and Bob. Everything in quantum mechanics involves Alice and Bob. And my colleagues, Mike, will let me get away with not having equations, but he wouldn't let me get away with not talking about Alice and Bob. So we have these two people, and Alice is going to prepare a coin and give it to Bob. And then Bob has a choice. He can either flip the coin or not. And he gives the coin back to Alice. And without looking at the coin, if Alice can prepare the coin and heads up, then she wins. Okay? And this, if she can't, of course, then Bob wins. This is a fair game. In fact, it's a very boring game. Half the time Alice will win and half the time Bob will win. And, you know, they won't go on with it very long. But if Alice went to IQC and learned about quantum mechanics, or she took the PSI subjects at the perimeter. So Alice is now a quantum mechanic, and she's going to prepare the coin, in a superposition state of heads plus tails. And I'm going to tell you about that state in a second. But she's going to prepare this coin in this state. It's a real state. It's one that we have access to. Not with the coin yet, but with actually pretty big objects. When she prepares this coin and she gives Bob the coin in the state heads plus tails, if Bob gives it back to her, he gives it back to her in the same state, heads plus tails. If he flips the coin, well, he takes heads plus tails to heads plus tails. So even if he flips the coin, he gives the coin back to Alice in the same state. And therefore, Alice can always prepare the coin in heads up state. And it's still a pretty boring game, but it's at least a little bit more interesting to Alice. So let's see what we can do about creating this superposition state, okay? I'm going to explain the superposition state in an experiment that we can do in the lab and where we can see the dynamics of that very clearly. I'm going to use neutron interferometry. So what we have is a beam of neutrons, and we can take, neutrons are of course very small particles, they have no charge. We can prepare a beam of neutrons that's very well collimated, very monoenergetic, and I can impinge it on the first blade of this interferometer. So what we're going to do is we'll take the neutron beam, you see it coming in from the lower left here, and it's going to hit this first blade. And this device right here, this piece, that is a perfect single crystal interferometer. The way we take this is we take a large single crystal of silicon, something which is about 10 or 20 centimeters, and we're going to machine from it those three blades. I'll explain why that's essential in a second, but let's look at the first blade and what happens. The neutrons come in, they interact with that first blade, and if we look down from the top of that first blade, we would see this object on the, I wonder if I can use that. Can you see that? Yes. If we look down over here on the top of this first blade, then what we would see is we look down on it, if we looked far enough, with high enough magnification, we would see atoms in that, and they would be arranged in a regular lattice, perfect lattice of silicon atoms in this case. Now you know, you've heard, that we can imagine objects as either waves or particles. So we can think about the neutron as a particle, but now I want to think about the neutron as a wave. The neutron is going to interact collectively with all of these atoms. So I've drawn it as a wave. It's coming in here from the lower left, interacting with the atoms in the crystal. And you notice that I've drawn it in such a way that it interacts in phase with each of those atoms. The wave function is at the same, the wave shape is at the same phase every time it interacts. And if you do that, Bragg showed that you could have two outcomes. You could have the neutron beam being transmitted, or you could have it being reflected. And that's what happens at the first blade. The neutron beam comes in a well-defined blade, well-defined beam, interacts with the first blade, and it undergoes Bragg scattering. And the outcome of the Bragg scattering is that there are two paths it can take. And it takes those as a coherent superposition of the neutron moving over those two paths. And now here I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble because I'd really like you to understand what superposition means. I'd really like you to understand what I mean when I say that it goes over these two paths, that the wave function spans those two paths. And it's very useful if I use the word wave function, because you can go through your whole day, probably weeks, maybe not this week, but most weeks, and not have to use the word wave function in an everyday life. You know, it's not an element of the classical world. And if I describe this too much to you, then we're going to put classical terms there, and you'll get the wrong idea. So I want to describe it to you in terms of experiments. So we have the neutron, and in this interferometer, there's never more than one neutron at a time. There's one neutron that's finding its way through this interferometer, and the wave function of the neutron is spread over those two paths. Now, when we look at the neutron going through, and what I've shown over on the right-hand side, over here, it's just a top-down picture of this interferometer. You see the neutron beam comes in from the lower left, gets split coherently into these two paths. It interacts with these blades. Now, remember that the whole interferometer is one single crystal. It's machined out of a pure single crystal. So this second blade, this one right here, this middle blade, is exactly the same orientation as the first blade. So what happens at the first blade is exactly what happens at the second blade, is exactly what happens at the third blade. And so this path, at that path, the neutron beam is coherently split into two other paths. What we're going to do is we're going to throw away the top path. It's going to go outside of the experiment, and it will be very important to us that the neutrons that leave the interferometer carry no unique information. Doesn't make sense now, but it will in a few moments, I promise you. So this top beam, we're going to take this blade right here, and this one, and they're going to look like mirrors. All they're going to do is reflect the path of the neutrons back into the interferometer. And so it looks like this. And the reason I want them to come back in the interferometer is they're going to meet at this third blade. And at that third blade, we're going to have an interference effect. So we have the neutron's wave function was spread out over two paths. It comes back together. When it comes back together, it can interfere. Okay. Now, as it comes back together, I'm going to draw everything now again as waves, just like we did when we talked about Bragg scattering to begin with. So I have the wave coming in from the lower parts of the wave function, another incoming one from the top, and two outgoing ones, right? That's the four paths that we had with the interferometer. This one, this one, this one, this one. Okay, the phase matters. And you can see what the phase would be. It would be a shift of that oscillation. You're used to this. This is a classical idea. All the physics I'm going to tell you about, you did before you were five. Take a straw and a glass of water, and of course you see that the straw looks broken because there's a refraction. The same thing happens in neutron interferometry. We put a little piece of silica in the path of the neutrons in one of the arms of this interferometer, and that little piece of silica slows down the neutrons. It takes them a little bit longer to go that way, and so it introduces a phase shift. And what that looks like, now it's shown, oh good, you can see it, I can't see it here. But there's a movie on the right, and you see this yellow line, it's moving up, it's changing its phase. I'm introducing a phase shift. And you can see on the right-hand side, the intensity of the two output beams varies. That depending upon the phase of that upper part, of the upper path, I can move the neutron from being in the upper output to lower output. Let's look at the data. Here's the real experiment. We have the neutron interferometer, we have a phase, and I've plotted over here the intensity of neutrons leaving this interferometer in the two arms, this arm and this arm, versus the width or the phase shift, versus the width of this piece of silica. And you nicely see that the intensity of the neutrons oscillates with that phase, and that there are places about here where I can put all the neutrons into one side. There's another place. I can put all the neutrons coming out the other side. And so this interference effect allows me to see what's going on. Now remember what happened. At the income, at the first blade, we had the neutrons coming in on only one path, and they went out with a wave function that spanned, that covered those two possible paths. We introduced a phase shift in one of them. They came back together, and now depending upon that phase shift, I can send the neutrons here or there, or a combination of both. All right, so now I've talked for 12 minutes, and so we have to have an exam. All right, so here's the exam. I'm going to set the phase on this neutron interferometer so that all the neutrons come out the upper path. Okay? That's what we're going to do. And then I'm going to block the lower path. I can take a piece of cadmium, and cadmium's a wonderful material for absorbing neutrons. So I put a piece of cadmium in that lower path. And now there will be no neutrons that go through that lower path. What's the output? Now remember that in the first blade over here, what happened? We had one beam coming in, we got two out, coherent superposition. Now we saw that when we had the coherent recombining of two beams, we could direct the positions. If I block the path and I have only one path leading to the third blade, what happens? Perfect, you're exactly right. That what happens is that we get the neutrons that come out over the two. And so you know that. You know all there is to know about quantum mechanics. You should go and talk to Neil Turek and ask him to give you a degree. Okay, let's describe what happened. I put a piece of cadmium here, and I really did block half the neutrons. Half the neutrons never got to the detector. And it seems like I'm losing something, but I'm actually gaining something. What I'm gaining is information. Remember that word information I told you would be important? Well, here's the next piece of that information. What I'm gaining is the knowledge that the only way the neutrons hit the detector was by taking that upper path. Now, you notice that a few minutes ago I said I was in trouble, that I had to describe superposition. It was going to be really tricky. Here, I'm not in trouble. I say all the neutrons take the upper path. Sounds really classical. And, of course, what we get out is a classical result. Anytime you can describe the system simply, classically, yeah, you lost your quantum mechanics, and life is not so good. But at least the description's easy. So that's what happened. We lost the coherence. I don't want to lose the coherence. I do want my computer to work. There we go. This is a state that's interesting. Here, I have the neutron wave function spread over this interferometer. This interferometer is 10 centimeters wide. I have one neutron going through it at a time, and the neutron is going to tell me about the phase difference of two paths that are separated by centimeters. This is a small particle. We're making a measurement of this small particle at some detector, and yet it's going to carry with it information that tells us about what is different about space separated by 10 centimeters. That is an incredibly powerful tool, and we're going to use that tool. But in order to use that tool, I need to keep the system coherent. I can't lose the information. I can't lose the quantum nature. And unfortunately, with neutron interferometers, it's very, very, very hard to keep coherence. And here's another piece of physics that you know from your youth. When the neutron interacts with that middle blade, you can see that it's going up and then it comes down. It's just like a ball bouncing. You take a ball, you throw it at that middle blade. Okay, your ball's a little small, it's a little neutron ball. You throw it at that middle blade and it comes back. Now, if that middle blade is moving away from you, or you throw a ball at a wall and the wall's moving away from you, then the ball's going to fall in front of you. The wall's going to steal some momentum from that ball, and it's not going to come back as energetically. If the wall's moving towards you and you throw the ball towards it, then the ball might end up over your head. It's going to, again, transfer information, and the ball will bounce back with more energy. The neutron interferometer, remember, is one single crystal. It moves as one piece. And very, very, very small vibrations of this absolutely destroy the coherence. Let's see how that works. So I take the neutron interferometer, and now the neutron is taking 50 microseconds. Neutrons meander at about 2,000 meters per second. So the neutron's meandering through this piece. It takes about 50 microseconds to go through the interferometer. But if the interferometer is vibrating, and let's say it's vibrating at about 10 hertz, a really nasty vibration that's hard to suppress, then it's going to look like it has a velocity for 100 milliseconds. It's going to be translated. And when it does that, the neutron that's going on this upper path, if the interferometer is moving up, hey, that's going to lose momentum. But the path, you see, I said it wrong there. I said the neutron that's going on the upper path. You can't say that. The part of the wave function that spans that upper path, it's going to get a kick of the momentum. The part of the wave function that spans the lower path, we'll get a kick of momentum with the opposite sign. And the result is this figure that I show on the right. But let me blow that up. I just want to look at where the neutrons come together. So this picture is exactly the same as this inner part, this inner diamond of the neutron interferometer. The neutrons split, well-defined. They bounce. When they bounce, they get different momenta, and they come back together. But because the momentum in the upper and lower paths is different, they don't come back together in the same place. And here's the outcome. I've just blown up that little piece. And these on the right are the coherence curves. for all of those different events of the interferometer moving up, the interferometer moving down, the interferometer changing amplitude. And you can see that we have a bunch of sine waves, just like we did before. So the sine waves looks good, except that I have all of these that I have to add up to see the experiment. And when I add them all up, what happens is that half the neutrons go this way and half the neutrons go that way. It looks like a very classical picture. I've lost all the coherence. The reason I've lost coherence is that I've added information. I've added information that says the neutrons coming from the upper path have one momentum, and the neutrons coming from the lower path have another momentum. And you can see that now it's a nice classical story, and we've lost all the good stuff. We want to avoid that. And up until about a year ago, we didn't know how to do it. But then quantum information processing told us how. And it's a really simple story. This picture just shows that experimentally we see that. Let me skip it. Let me tell you the story. The story is this, that what I want to do is I want to have the neutrons forget about the fact that they bounced off that first wall. And so there's a nice theory called dynamical decoupling or decoherence-free subspaces, and they give you a bunch of math of how you can calculate and remove the information. But what they really need to do is to say, look, what you have to do is twist and knock it again, okay? And that's important. You got to remember that. Twist and knock it again, okay? So here's what we do. We have the neutron. It's taking this path. Remember what happened is if the interferometer was moving up, it lost momentum. But at this point, down here, it hits another blade, it gains momentum. If it took the red path, it goes down, it gains momentum, comes up, it loses momentum. By putting in this additional blade, we suppress the information about the path that the neutron took. And now we recover coherence. And that's what we show in this figure, that whether we have vibrations or not, in this particular geometry, we always have quantum coherence. We can always measure things. This is really surprising, that neutron interferometry, as I said, it's been around since the 70s. When we came up with this idea, we went and talked to the people at NIST, and they have a wonderful way of dealing with vibrations. They took their lab, and they dug a big hole in it. And then they put some vibration isolation equipment in there, and they put a big cement slab on it. And then they put some vibration isolation equipment on that big slab, and they built a room around it. And then they put another table, and then they put some more vibration isolation equipment, and they built another room around it. And they kept doing this until the level of vibrations was really, really small. It took them a few years to make it. It's a wonderful, wonderful vibration-free setting. But it's so big, it's moved the experiment away from the source of neutrons. And so by the time the neutron gets through all of that vibration isolation, there's no neutrons left. But there's no vibrations either. So you get a very clean experiment, so you just don't have any signals. You have a little bit of signals, and it's nice. But I went and took this idea to the designers of that system. And I said, hey, why don't we do this instead for vibration isolation? And immediately, they said, hey, that's a good idea. Yes, we'll do that. It'll work. And I think, hold on, man. You spent 4 or 5 years building this thing. You've been using it for 30 years. And now you tell me that in 30 seconds, oh, we should do this instead. Why didn't you do this, before? And of course, the answer was they didn't think about it. That up until recently, till the work that's done here in IQC, if you wanted to bring these ideas to quantum information theory, you had to have insight. You had to have a creative idea. You had to bring something new and novel and unexpected to the problem. Now we have theories that tell us if you have this sort of noise, this is how you get rid of it. And these theories allow us to actually do engineering quantum mechanically. And that's what we're going to talk about, how we can engineer the system to preserve coherence and to use that quantum information to do things that we might like to do. Okay, so remember, the important point here was that if you want to avoid errors, you need to twist your system and then give it another kick with the environment just like it had before. Okay. So now, neutrons are great, but this neutron interferometer is big. It has to be in a lab. It has to be next to a neutron reactor. And what I want to do is to have ubiquitous quantum computers. We have lots of quantum computers. So I'm going to make a mapping. I'm going to use protons instead of neutrons. And so if I think about a proton is a hydrogen nucleus. And a proton is a small bar magnet. And I'm going to put the small bar magnets into some object of interest. Nature will do that, actually. And then I'll put the whole thing in a magnetic field. And you know what happens. If you have a bar magnet in a magnetic field, it has to adopt one of two states. It's either going to be aligned with the field or against the field. And you can think that you have a compass, and your compass is usually pointed north. In fact, you count on your compass pointing north. But in fact, it's very easy to have your compass point south. Now, of course, as soon as you knock it, it'll rotate around and point north again. But there's an unstable equilibrium point that says it can point south. And so if I have a compass, which is a bar magnet, in a field, like the Earth's field, then there are two allowed states, up and down. Okay? And those are the mappings that we're going to use. We're going to say, if the magnetic moment is pointed up, that's like it took the upper path. And if the magnetic moment is pointing down, that's like it took the lower path. And so this spin, this proton, looks just like this neutron interferometer. Now remember that the important point was the coherence. So we have the state up, the state down, but we need a coherent superposition of up and down, and that's the state pointing in the horizontal plane, okay? So that's the coherent superposition state. And remember that there was a phase in the neutron interferometer that we would adjust this phase flag over here to change the phase. And the change of phase with spins is very easy. They just rotate. And if we have spins in an applied magnetic field, very much like MRI, if you're familiar with that, the spins precess, and so they pick up a phase. So we can do that quite simply. Okay, so now then we have our system, our quantum system, which is one proton. Now, here I've tried to carry this analogy a little bit further. We have our neutron interferometer. Remember that we measured the contrast coming out to the neutron interferometer, which is just the intensity in this arm and the intensity in this arm plotted here as a function, in this case, of the width of this phase flag. In the lower trace here, what I've plotted out is the magnetic moment of the spins. And I've plotted out the x and y component. So if I start with the spins in a superposition state pointed along x, then they're going to rotate to y. And so you see this sinusoidal oscillation as the spins rotate. But you see one more really important thing. You see, as the spins rotate, they lose coherence. The vector gets shorter. So as we rotate, the vector becomes shorter and shorter. And over time, we lose the quantum information. And the challenge in using protons as a quantum computer or a quantum information processor is to keep that coherence. Because as we saw with the neutron, that coherence is what allows us to make interesting measurements. So let's talk about interesting measurements. If I have protons, a really nice sample of protons is water. H2O has two protons. And so we can look at where we would use magnetic resonance to study protons. And of course, you're probably more familiar with using protons to study using magnetic resonance for medical resonance imaging, MRI, or maybe for drug discovery and other things. I'm going to talk about what are, applications that are more directly relevant to us today. So let's talk about things where magnetic resonance makes a big difference. And to do that, I need to introduce one more concept. This is the last one. But I need to introduce this one more concept. And the concept is that I can take this phase and I can make it depend upon location. Remember that what happened was we said that we had the spin and that the spin was going to precess in a magnetic field. What I didn't tell you is that the rate of precession is proportional, directly proportional, to the strength of the magnetic field. So if I have a strong magnetic field, the spins process quickly. If I have a weak magnetic field, they process slowly. If I have a magnetic field gradient, so if the magnetic field up here is strong and the magnetic field down here is weak, these will process quickly and these will process slowly. And I'll get myself all wound up here, but that's what will happen. And I've tried to display that over here. One, I've tried to show that the magnetic field is increasing as we go up. And here we have the precession of the spins. And of course, as they process, they'll eventually loop each other. They'll eventually, I forget what it's called in racing, but they'll lap each other. And that's what's happened. We have the spins lapping each other. And it winds up into a helix. It winds up just like the threads on a bolt. Okay? So we have a helix of these spins. Okay? But they're coherent. We're going to use that coherence. All right. Let's talk about cheese. So if we're looking at magnetic resonance of cheese, it's actually a very important application. You have a piece of cheese, and it's very important to you to know how the water channels in cheese are present. If I have a creamy cheese, I don't want to have channels of water going through the cheese, because what will happen is that the mold will move very quickly through those channels and the cheese will rot. If I have a little bit tastier cheese, then of course I might want some veins of water going through the cheese so that I can induce some nice growth that's going to give it some flavor. Okay? So what we want to know in cheese, and this is an important application of magnetic resonance, what I want to know in cheese is how the water transports through the cheese. And look at these two pictures of these helices of spins. If I have a helix sitting over here, and then I translate it through a flow, through the velocity of water moving through these channels. If it moves, then as it moves that helix picks up a phase shift. The difference between this helix and this one, which is translated, is simply a phase. And that phase, of course, is constant for every spin. The way I imagine this is this spin got moved here, and that spin got moved there, etc. Everyone got moved up, and when they got moved up, there was a phase shift introduced. And that phase shift directly tells us what the velocity of water is through these. And if we have channels, then we'll have transport of water through these channels, and we can measure, characterize the structure of cheese. Now, if this was a quantum computer, it would have changed. Here we go. Now, perhaps you're not interested in cheese. It could be. So we'll talk about chocolate. Now, the problem in chocolate is completely different. If you have chocolate, what you really want it to do is to melt. If you hold the chocolate bar between your fingers, it should melt. Of course, it'd be nice to melt in your mouth, too. But, you know, to test it, you say, okay, I'm going to pinch it between my fingers and it should melt. And the reason it's going to melt is that we have an emulsion. We have little particles of fat, and they're dispersed through the chocolate. And it's very important to us that those little particles are not connected and that they're of a uniform size. You can see that if you're asking for something to melt, if I have some really, really small particles and some really big ones, the small ones are going to melt first. We don't want that. If you leave a cheese out, you know, you go camping, cheese, chocolate out. If you leave chocolate out, and you go, say you go camping with a bar of chocolate, but you forget to eat it. You know, you come back, and now there's a chocolate store just down the street, and you take this thing out of your backpack, and you're never going to eat that one, right? That it's been cycled in temperature and pressure, and it's phase separated, and it's got the scum on the surface, and maybe some clunky pieces if you're old enough to have been around in one of the world wars. You know that the chocolates then were really waxy, things that we wouldn't want to eat today. I'm sure wonderful at the time. So what we want to know is, in the processing of chocolate, can we create these little spheres of emulsion and keep them. Now look at what we do. We take our helix. We arrange for a period of this helix, the repeat unit, to be the same size as one of these pools of fat. And then if I looked at the spins within that pool of fat, they would all be lined up roughly in the same direction. And if we carried out an experiment, it's a little bit more complicated, but if I made a measurement, I would see a signal from that. Now think about what would happen if I had that sphere, that particle of emulsion, twice as large. So then it spanned two periods of my helix. Then in some places in that emulsion, the spins would be pointing this way. In some places, they'd be pointing that way. On average, they're pointing nowhere, and you would get no signal. And so it's very easy, once you have this spatial helix of spins, to characterize the size of these particles. And that is done too, not as frequently as cheese, but it is also for good chocolate studied. Now I want to bring these two ideas together. And so I wanted to talk about well logging, a very, very important field. And right now, there are places where we're drilling wells. You drill down a few kilometers, and now you have a pipe, a hole in the ground, that goes down a few kilometers. And somewhere along there, you hope that there is some oil. And you know that a lot of places along there, there's water. And you're going to send down a device, many devices, to make measurements along the well so that you know where to perforate. And of course, what you want to do is to perforate where there's oil. Don't perforate where there's water. And you have one more very important piece of information. You want to make sure that you perforate where there's oil and the oil is going to flow. It doesn't do you any good to perforate where there's oil if the oil is sitting like the oil in a chocolate bar. Nothing's going to happen. It's just going to stay there. What I show on the right here is a picture of a limestone, a carbonate. And what you see here is some pretty big pieces of rock. And what you don't see, if I zoomed in on them, what you would see is that it's made up of little crystallites. And between the crystallites, there's fluid. Okay? And so this is a common oil-containing rock. And what it has is a bunch of very tightly held pores that might have oil or water in them. And then it has a bigger space that might have oil or water in it. And in the bigger space, the fluid's going to move. In the tight space, it's very unlikely that the fluid will move. We wanted to be able to differentiate those two. And there's wonderful stories. There's an example in Norway where they were doing a well logging, and all of the measurements came up and said that what they had seen was water. And so the answer came back to the field to abandon the well. What they do is they pour cement in the well and they forget about it and go drill another one. And a young engineer at the site said, no, he wants to run another NMR tool. And young engineers don't have the right to do that. And the cost of that is hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, you know, he's not worrying about his retirement package yet. So he goes ahead and does this, and he finds that what he discovers that there's very, very light oil, very clean oil, and that it's moving. He produces the well, and it's one of the biggest finds of oil in Norway. The flip side is in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, they were drilling for water. Saudis don't need more oil. And if you have to choose between having oil and water, you want water. So the Saudis were drilling for water. And they found this beautiful formation, had lots and lots of water in it. So they said, yeah, great, let's produce that. And they produce it, and what comes up is a little bit of really clean, nice oil. And then what happened is there were lots and lots of water, but it was all in this pore space. It wasn't moving. And the oil, there wasn't a lot of it, but it was in these large volumes, these large areas around the pores, and that was easy to move. So let me tell you what the problem is and how we solve it. You know, why don't we always get the right answer? The reason we don't get the right answer always when you use magnetic resonance is we're not looking at a homogeneous material. If I'm looking at the cheese, then I'm looking at the magnetic field, but there's air bubbles, there's whey, there's all sorts of other things in cheese. And all of these heterogeneities distort the local magnetic field. If I'm looking at chocolate, then we have milk products in there that distort the magnetic field. It's just, you know, it looks homogeneous when you look at it, but if you bear down deep enough to try to see these pores, it's very, very heterogeneous. And of course, the oil well, that is really heterogeneous, right? So you have all sorts of distortions. And what I've plotted here with this sphere is the distortions in the local magnetic field gently due to having a foreign object in the field. So if I, you know, remember this picture of the glass, and we saw the straw broken. That was this distortion because of the two types of materials, water and air. Here, we have a distortion from the magnetic lines because we have two types of material, the material out in free space, and whatever it is within this sphere. And I've simply color-coded the magnetic field. I don't give you any scale, but it doesn't matter. It varies over the sphere. And to the right here, I've plotted out the coherence decay from this picture for each slice. I've said, oh yeah, if I'm sitting up here, I get this coherence decay. If I'm sitting down here, I get this one. If I'm sitting over here, I get that one over there. And you can see, it's very much like the neutron case, that these things oscillate. They last a long time. But we don't get to look at them in isolation. The only thing we can do when we look down a bore hole is we can detect the signal from all of these features. When we detect the signal from all of these features, we get a response that looks pretty much like the one at the bottom, the added sum of all of these. And we see that the coherence vanishes very quickly. And so now, instead of having this nice long time to make a precise measurement and to get the right answer, I have only this short little moment to try to learn what's going on. It's not enough time. We make mistakes. Somebody drills a well in the wrong place. Life is a real drag. Or, you know, you come into your refrigerator and you have a nice piece of cheese that you're going to have for supper, and it's rotted. This is the problem. This is why your cheese rotted. Okay. So remember what we did with the neutron case. We had this same sort of picture of, hey, lots of little places where there's coherence, but because we identified the path, because we separated the upper path and the lower path, and we said that there's a momentum difference, so we know which way the neutron went, we got this combination of many, many outcomes, and we averaged over all of those outcomes, and we saw that half the neutrons went this way and half went that way. No interest. But we had a solution, right? The solution was twist and knock, right? So all we had to do is take that interferometer, twist it once, and then give it a knock again. And the knock is let it interact with the environment in a second time in exactly the same way it interacted the first time. Okay, so we do that in magnetic resonance. So, we wind up our helix. So I take the spin, starts off here, put it into a coherent state, allow it to wind up in the magnetic field gradient. We get this nice spatial helix. And now what I want to do is to twist it. I want to go from having a right-handed helix to a left-handed helix. Okay? And that is an old piece of technology I'm going to talk about in just a second. That is easy to do, but you can see what would happen. You know that if you have a left-handed screw, we don't have many of them around, but you can buy them, that you can't put it in a right-handed nut, right? It goes the wrong way. Instead of going like this, it goes like that, yeah? And if I wind up a helix in a left-handed way, and then I use if I wind up the helix in a right-handed way, and then I convert it to a left-handed helix, And if I put it back in the same magnetic field gradient, it would all unwind and everything would end up back where it started. But I'm not going to do that. I take the helix, I take the magnetic field increasing the first time, wind up the right-handed helix, yeah? Then I flip that helix over, make it a left-handed helix, and then what do? I put it into a magnetic field that is varying, that's strongest at the bottom and weakest at the top. Okay, so I essentially wind it up twice. Okay. Now, the challenge in doing this is it's really, really easy to apply these gradients. It's really easy to apply a magnetic field that's going to wind up one direction or wind up the other direction. That Maxwell could do, and that was 2 centuries ago now. But up until this year, if we wanted to go from this left-handed helix to this right-handed helix, we would apply one simple pulse. What I would say is, let's wind up everything into a helix, and then I'm going to take the magnetization that's along the x-axis, and I'm going to move it to the y, to the minus x-axis. Okay, that's all I'm going to do. And we could do that with one pulse, and in the laboratory setting where these things were developed, it works really well. But in the real life, where we have all these local fields, it performs really abysmally. It doesn't perform well in the presence of noise. And so now what we do is something called optimal control theory, that Troy Borneman, one of my students, takes this problem and he creates this really messy-looking pulse. But that really messy-looking pulse works really well over a wide range of distorted fields. And I'll show you some of his data. So what I've plotted here, I being Troy did all this, is the resonance offset says how bad is the noise. So at the middle, zero noise. As we walk over here, more noise. As we walk over here, more noise. And just worry about the blue line at top. The top line should be one. And over a wide range of noise, it's very close to one. In the old experiments, that shaded area is the only place that it would be anywhere near one. After it got outside of that, it would be zero. And so we have an inability with these systems to actually do this refocusing step. We had an inability to remove the information that the local fields had put in there. So now, let me go back. Here. We say, yep. What I've done is I've said that I've got this local distortion to the magnetic fields. This local distortion is killing our coherence on average over the sample. And now I'm going to take that local distortion and I'm going to refocus it. And I'm going to refocus it regardless of what the amplitude is, regardless of what its structure is. That's what Troy does. He says, hey, we'll take and design as an experiment so that regardless of how bad things get, we can always go from a right-handed helix to a left-handed helix, and we can do it precisely. Once we do that, then we can refocus the internal gradients, we can measure these spatial distributions. We can measure what happens in the chocolate, the cheese, and in the oil wells. And that works really, really well. Now, there's, of course, a long story we could tell about exactly why this pulse is the right pulse and how that works. It's all worked out in great detail. It all functions quite well. But the important point, or the point I would like to get across, is that these ideas of quantum information theory are being applied today directly on problems of broad societal interest, and even as some simple examples as how do we process cheese? How do we ensure that chocolate will melt? How do we find oil? Even these questions, we can take the ideas of quantum information science and use them to improve our ability to answer those questions. Now, of course, it would be fun to spend the time and tell you about even wider ranges of problems. I don't have the time, so I won't do that today. I want to give you one counterexample of where the noise is really important. So here's an MRI. So the same technology, we're still looking at protons, we're still looking at water in the brain. And on the left, we have an anatomical image. And there, we really do want to suppress the heterogeneities in the brain. The heterogeneities come from that we have cerebral spinal fluid, we have white matter, we have gray matter, and we don't want to see magnetic field differences between those. What we want to see is a correct mapping. And yeah, that's a nice image. On the right-hand side, superimposed on an anatomical image of the brain is the so-called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And the functional means that we're measuring hemodynamic response. It's an old idea in neuroscience that if your part of your brain is thinking, blood rushes to that part of the brain. Blood in its oxygenated and deoxygenated states is magnetic. And so that when the blood rushes to that part of the brain, it changes the magnetic environment. And that gives us a signature of where there's blood flow and hence where there's neural activity in the brain. And so what we do in these experiments, I don't, others do, is to put a person into a high magnetic field, ask them to think about something interesting or shows them a picture of something interesting and looks and see where the brain lights up. In that case, the contrast is exactly this noise we're suppressing. In this case, if we suppress the noise, the signal would go away. So there's times where we want to keep the noise. And one of the nice things is that if we can take the noise and we can remove it, you can trust me, we can always make the noise worse. Okay. Now, most of what you're going to hear this week is about quantum computing. And we can use the same technology to do quantum computing. And I show you on the left here a molecule, histidine, that's much, much more complicated, of course, than water, which has 13 spins that we use in a quantum processor. So work that we do at MIT and we do at IQC in Waterloo. And here, we can have a universal quantum computer at the level of 13 qubits. Now, 13 spins seems pretty small, but I remind you that quantum power is much more impressive than classical power. 13 spins is about the equivalent of this PDP-11, which when I was a graduate student, or maybe an undergraduate, was a nice toy. It was a very powerful computer made by Digital. It was about the size of a refrigerator, so it really did look impressive. And it had 8K of memory. But we could do lots of nice physics on that. Now, we need to get beyond 13 spins, of course. What we'd like to do is to have hundreds of spins. And that's what we're working on at IQC. So what you should do, I hope, is first come over to the tent. In the tent, we've set up a little 2-qubit quantum computer. And you can go in there and play with it. It's based upon spins. It's not based upon nuclear magnetic resonance. Well, it is, but not in that way. It's based upon nuclear quadrupole resonance. And so instead of the spins being dipoles, they're quadrupoles. Okay, and that has an advantage in that I don't need to have a superconducting magnet sitting in the tent. And so we can take up a little bit less real estate. And if you go in there, we'll be able to show you that with this system, we can perform operations over 2 quantum bits. In fact, you can perform operations over 2 quantum bits, and they'll work in real time. Immediate gratification. Life is good. And go over there and make sure the students tell you about quadrupole resonance, what that looks like. And then today, later on today, come by IQC, and you can find the more complicated work that we're doing there. Okay, so if you want to know how do we get beyond 13 qubits, come. And there's a panel discussion from 1 to 2:30. At 2:30, there'll be a tour of the labs, and you can see what's going on in the experimental side over there. So thank you very much. Thanks for your attention. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, David. So if you have questions, please come over to this side and speak them into the microphone. Try to be as clear and succinct as you can.
Maybe can I get the sound on this? While we're waiting for people to come over, I've got a question. Okay, while we're waiting for people to come over, I have a question from our online audience. Tatiana from Toronto asks, could we use this technology on the Mars Science Laboratory, the next Mars rover, to find find water in the subsurface with certainty?
It's a great question. Yes, we could use it. I don't know enough about the exploration there to say that it's the best way of doing it, but using magnetic resonance to find water subsurface is in fact an important application. And if you're in Siberia, then there are domes of water. So there's the freeze-thaw cycle, the permafrost leads to underground domes of water, and that's their important source of water. They'd like to find this. And what they do is they have a truck that drives around. These permafrost domes are really, really big. And the truck lays out a cable as it drives around the whole process and behind it. And it looks for the NMR signal in the Earth's magnetic field. And they can find these permafrost domes and tell how deep the permafrost domes are. It actually turns out to be a real challenging thing to do, because they're laying out a very, very heavy cable. They're laying out about a kilometer of it, and you have to get the truck to go in a circle and end up back where you started at the end of the cable. If you do that, if you don't do that, you're out of luck. The cable's too heavy to move. You have to go through the whole thing. So there's lots of different skills you need to bring to bear to this. So it's a great way to find subsurface water. I don't know enough about Mars to say that it's the right application there.
I'm interested in what you sort of referred to as Troy's pulse, and wondering whether, you know, how you came up with it, or how he came up with it, and whether it's provably optimal.
Thank you for the question. And there's a set of algorithms for finding this. And basically, what this pulse does is it says, hey, here's, for those that know this, here's a set of Hamiltonians. For those that don't know it, here's a set of noise in energies in the system. And I want to perform a precise rotation regardless of what that is. That's as though you're going to say, hey, you're in a room full of toddlers, and you want to turn around. And as you're doing that, they're all going to be jumping on you and bumping you. And you want to say, okay, regardless of how they come at me and how many of them are, I want to make this precise motion. And that's the sort of calculation we do. The algorithms allow us to find a wide range of pulses. So we find many, many solutions. And out of all of these, we can calculate the precision with which we carry out this rotation over a wide range of noise. And so we can benchmark our performance. It's optimal in the sense that we get the right rotation. So it's not the optimal pulse. We don't know if there is an optimal pulse. There are many that do the same or similar things. But the word optimal there means it does the right thing.
I have another question from our online audience. Raghu from Waterloo says, currently I'm in second year electrical engineering. I'm wondering if I have to study a lot of algebra to truly understand or appreciate this topic.
So, to understand it, I don't think you do. I think that to understand what we're doing here, we can understand that in simple models. Now, since he's at Waterloo, and I'm moving to Waterloo, then I hope he would come work for me. And if he did, then I would ask him to take linear algebra. And the reason is that when we think when we talk amongst ourselves, we have a shorthand of how we describe these systems. And that shorthand does depend upon linear algebra. Now, I've had wonderful high school students. Every year at MIT, have high school students come into labs and do things. And with matrix multiplication that most people see in high school, they can understand what's going on in quantum mechanics, and they can make unique and valued contributions to the field. This is such a wide open field that everyone that comes to it with a different perspective, and of course, you know, it's a new field, you're going to come to it with your own perspective. You have to build intuition. We don't have that yet. Can make a contribution. So it's a great time to be working in this field.
I have one other question, personally. Just wondering, what's the strangest application you've ever seen of NMR? Chocolate? Cheese? Anything weirder?
Those aren't strange. Those are everyday applications. A colleague of mine, Paul Callahan, took his research lab to Antarctica. And what he wanted to do is to characterize the melting of ice. You know that's one of the challenges in Antarctica is that we're losing the ice shelf. And we can run NMR experiments to characterize the different structures of ice. So, you know, we think of ice maybe not here. In Boston, we think of ice as a real simple thing. We don't see it often enough to have a rich lexicon of ice. Maybe it's a little bit richer here, but you go to Antarctica, it's really rich. And there's all of this slushy ice and porous ice and, I don't know, many, many terms. And they can use NMR to characterize the pore structure and the flow of the ice and the viability of the ice shelf. And so there are very important applications looking at environmental issues.
Thank you.
So if I could ask you just one last question, actually picking up on the second last question. That was an engineering student, so clearly there's a lot of things an engineering student can do. What could students study if they're interested in this sort of thing?
At MIT, we have this policy that research labs don't belong to departments. They belong to laboratories. And so my research lab at MIT sits in the magnet lab, and we have students that come into the lab from physics, from math, from computer science, from nuclear engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, chemistry, chemical engineering, I'm sure civil engineering. I'm sure I've left out some things. But they all come and they can all make a different contribution, that building quantum computers is, we need to know a lot about, of course, quantum mechanics. We need to know a lot about information science. I hope that I conveyed that enough. I probably didn't. What's really new in quantum information theory is the word information. That we think about how the flow of information goes through these processes. And as you know, this has opened up a new set of ways of thinking about the underlying quantum mechanics. And so we need to have this rich community working together. We need to have the computer scientists actually in the lab working with the physicists. We need the chemists to work making materials right in conjunction with mathematicians and mechanical engineers. And that's the advantage that you're going to see if you wander over to IQC. The IQC has that same model, that everyone at IQC is focused on building a quantum computer. And they come with their skills from a wide range of backgrounds.
Well, thanks very much, David, for the great talk and for taking the questions. Before we leave you, there's a few reminders. The next event is 9 billion people plus one planet equals, and that's how I'm pronouncing the question mark symbol. And that's at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And don't forget to check out all the other Q2C events by going to q2cfestival.com. Many thanks to those of you attending here at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And thank you to those of you watching online. This presentation will be available on demand, so please share the festival website link with others who you think will be interested. The chapter's bookstore is open at the back of the atrium with a selection of books on the festival themes. And as our next session is going to start relatively soon, we'd appreciate your help by exiting the theater on the ground floor at the back. Please join me in thanking the speaker one last time.